Welcome to Avery Adventures Podcast. This is Ryan Avery. I'm here with Jake from Unknown Munitions again. This is going to be part two of Ammo Deconstructed. Part one, we covered everything equipment. You can go back to the last podcast on whatever podcast player you like to use, or AveryAdventures.com, and you can listen. I strongly suggest you listen to the first one. And this one is going to be about the unknown munition process. This may not be your process, but this is how Jake and the crew, I should say Jessica and the crew, make ammunition from basically from virgin brass out the door to your house. Jake, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ryan. Glad to be here for episode two.
Yeah, the first one got, I'm used to getting feedback, but this one got a lot of feedback. Yeah. It's funny to me how the reloading process is, I wouldn't say voodoo, but it's definitely something people think about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And your process is probably, I would imagine there's only so many ways you can hand load brass, but your process is your process, and it's putting out quality ammunition.
Yeah. I think a lot of people like to, hang on to their secrets or whatever they think their secret sauce might be for,
yes,
you know, how they're loading, or you see a guy with, you know, a 3ES or something like that and doesn't want to share his secret to how he got there. Well, we're not worried about secrets. We like to spread the wealth and spread the knowledge and get it out there. So
no, you know, the first thing that really didn't surprise me, but it was different, was when we got going with your guys' ammunition, I started shooting it a lot. You had no qualms putting the load on the box, saying what the load is when people would ask. Mm-hmm. And that was refreshing in the reloading, hand loading side of the house, because everybody has their top secret recipes, which is all bullshit.
Yeah.
There's only so many ways you can do it. There's only so much powder you can put in a case.
Yeah. So, yeah. If you say you use 41 grains, H4350 and 6.5 Creedmoor, it's not really a secret. You know, that's pretty much
no
the load to go for.
But there's people out there that still hold on to that. Well, I can't tell you. I don't know if it's because I don't want you to blow yourself up, or they really think it's a secret.
You know, there is a lot of, I guess, liability concern with, and we talk about that when we do the in-person reloading class. Really, the most unsafe part of loading is proper powder choice. So picking a powder that is in the right burn rate zone for the cartridge you're loading, that's really where the big problems can happen. In pistol, you can double charge a case and really cause a lot of problems. In rifle, you can't really double charge a case because we're filling everything up. But what you can do is fill it up with the wrong powder. And, you know, we've had friends and we've seen situations on social media and otherwise where guys have made that mistake, and not because they wanted to, but more because they grabbed the wrong bottle of powder or something like that. And bad things can happen. And it has to be pretty drastic. You have to go from one end of the burn rate chart to the other to really, you know, cause a lot of issues. If you're four or five notches up or down, it's probably okay. But some issues.
If you go from like Farget into a 300 Ultra, that's where you could get in trouble.
Yeah.
But I see you're like fail-safe. Every one of your powder measures has the powder listed right on top of it.
Yes, we run three tricklers per station, and each station is really for one specific powder. When we talk about powder changes, you know, only certain people can do certain things as far as changing powder or refilling powder, and we have a lot of processes in place to eliminate the chance of mistake. But yeah, I guess we should get into the process at
process. this is part two. I don't know how many actual parts we're going to have, but the more that you guys give us feedback, the more we'll put out. So I guess it all starts with virgin brass.
Yeah, so virgin brass. So again, we're not really going to talk about each individual piece of equipment, but more just about the process. So new brass comes in. Our very first step is to expand it. That's pretty self-explanatory. Expander mandrel housing, expander mandrel. I will touch on, I've had some questions, and it actually pertained to the first podcast. Guys asking about neck tension and using a expander mandrel versus a neck turning mandrel. So when they're going on to purchase their mandrel for the first time, it's important to know that the expander mandrel is 1/1000th under bullet diameter and the neck turning mandrel is 2/1000ths under bullet diameter. So what that can do for you is, if you like to run a little bit more neck tension, if you use that 2/1000ths neck turning mandrel, you're not pushing the neck out as much as you did with the expander mandrel. So you can run an extra 1/1000th of neck tension compared to what we do in our process. And that is, I would say that the most beneficial process that would be for gas gun because of the way, and explaining why that's beneficial for that too, the way the bolt rams forward and grabs that piece of ammunition out of the magazine, and it kind of hits that feed ramp and launches it up into the chamber there. That's a pretty quick action. It's not a delicate kind of bolt rifle coming forward nice and easy. So if you run a little bit more neck tension on that bullet, it might resist, you know, cocking the bullet, moving the bullet, I guess, laterally from the line of the case as it's entering the chamber. So if you're doing any hand loads for gas gun, you can run an extra thousandth of neck tension simply by ordering the neck turning mandrel instead of the expander mandrel. Gotcha. So we do run expander mandrels. And again, remember that you have about 5/10,000ths of spring back on well annealed brass. So an expander mandrel will set the tension at 0.0015 or 1.5 thousandths. Versus if you used a neck turning mandrel, it would be 0.0025 or 2.5 thousandths. So important to kind of visualize that. In class, we use some diagrams to illustrate this. But if you picture the just looking into the top of the neck of the brass, the mandrel's pushing that neck outwards and making it bigger. But the brass wants to return to its original shape. That's the spring back or the brass pulling back in. And that's about 5/10,000ths again for well annealed brass.
When you guys have like the, when you guys get in and you have little nicks, you know, at the very top of the neck and you run them through there, do you guys ever notice anything when you actually see a bullet? I always see people like, well, I put the expander in and I leave it there for a second with the ones that are necked up. Do you see anything that, does that matter at all?
I think they believe that when they leave the mandrel in the case mouth longer, it allows the brass to accept that new position easier, or they think there's basically, the longer you leave it in there, the less spring back you'll have. If the brass is at the most relaxed state possible, in other words, it's fully annealed, there's really no, there is a wall there where it can't be more annealed once it's fully annealed, right? So if all the brass is fully annealed, it's going to pull back in the same amount. So I think just being consistent is the most important. We don't time how long we leave the case mouth around the mandrel. It goes, you know, it's up and down. It's a pull and a draw.
Gotcha.
So expanding will be the first step. And again, if you did have some type of nick or something that was on the inside of the case mouth before you expand, it's very possible that that will now transfer like a mirror image to the outside. So it's important to make sure you don't flare something out if there's some, you know, critical damage there. But generally with bulk brass, it's just a dinged neck. So the brass is just deformed a bit, and the expander takes care of that for you. So again, the expander is setting the diameter for the neck tension. It is making sure the case mouth is perfectly concentric or a perfect circle before you trim it, because our trimmer is a three-way trimmer. So it's chamfering the inside of the case mouth, it's deburring the outside, and it's trimming the whole case to length. So if you have some type of ding in the mouth, because it's that the trimming action is rotational and it's a perfect circle, if you hadn't expanded first and there was even a slight ding in the case mouth that you couldn't see, you now have damaged the brass because of that trimming process, because it's rotating. So that's why we expand first. It moves on to the three-way trimmer. So deburr, chamfer, trim to length. Those are the three options of a three-way trimming tool. And again, consistency is key. So the amount of chamfer or the angle of chamfer on the inside of the case mouth is critical. And that's to control your neck tension. So I guess if you're not using some type of motorized three-way trimmer, if you're doing it manual with a hand tool, it's important to be as consistent as possible. I started with hand tools in our process way back when, and I'd recommend the Sinclair. Here we are talking about equipment.
It's in our nature.
Yeah, Sinclair VLD carbide for the hand tool there. It's sharp, cuts quick, and you can get the right angle and duplicate your cuts. So we move through the Henderson three-way trimmer, which is using basically a Forster-style three-way trimmer head. Yeah, so that's the first two steps of new brass.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, we move into priming, which is, you know, pretty self-explanatory, but we're pushing a primer into the case.
It is self-explanatory, but I really didn't know the depth that you could go into the different depths, I guess I should say, of priming. So,
yeah, so primer seating depth consistency is probably what you're looking for as the key measurement of how effective you are in the priming operation. So you can do this with, you know, any number of tools. Obviously, you can do it by hand with like a 21st century hand primer, any number of bench priming tools. But really what you're trying to do is measure the consistency of primer seating depth from one case to another. Hollins makes a primer seating depth gauge. That's what we use here to measure. But any basically depth micrometer that would apply to the right depth, you're only looking for, you know, at max 10 thousandths depth, I would say. So whatever tool it is you're looking for. But if you call Hollins and just tell them you want to order that primer depth gauge, I think she charges me $60 or so. So seating the primer, generally what you're also looking for is as that firing pin is coming forward when you pull the trigger, you don't want the primer to have forward motion in the cartridge before the detonation happens. So making sure that your primer cup is bottomed out inside the primer pocket is important. Now, how you'd figure that out is to measure the height of just the primer cup, and it's important when you're looking at the when you're looking at the primer from a side profile. Often the anvil or the we'll just call it the guts of the primer is hanging out below the actual cup. So when you're measuring the height of the primer cup, make sure you're just getting the cup, not the whole guts and everything. And then you can measure the depth of your primer pocket with the back end of your caliper. So if you're using a Mitutoyo, whatever caliper you might be using, there's another function of measurement, which is on the ass end, which maybe most guys don't pay attention to. But as you open up your caliper, there's a probe that comes out from the backside, and that's a depth probe. So that would be what you'd use to measure your primer pocket depth. So if we imagine for a moment that our primer pocket depth is, we'll just put round numbers on it, 35 thousandths. Primer pocket depth is 35 thousandths. And we measure the primer cup height, and the primer cup height is 30 thousandths. We know that in order for the primer cup to be bottomed out in the primer pocket, it needs to be 5 thousandths below flush.
Correct.
So when you go to seat your primer the first time, whatever tool you might be using, you would measure your depth, and the depth you'd be looking for in that situation is 5 thousandths. Now you can dig a lot further into this, and I think I'm pretty excited. I think we'll have Greg Dykstra on at some point from Primal Rights, and we'll get real nitty gritty about the primer,
real nerdy on the primers
and crush and whatnot, and how that, you know, applies to load development and consistency. But for the time being, if you're just starting off, just make sure that your primer cup is bottomed out, and even then, you don't even have to worry about that first. I mean, you should just worry about the depth being consistent.
Real quick on that. So say you're at flush on some, and then you're at the 5 thousandths below. What would you see in the actual shot?
Well, I think you'll end up seeing, you know, standard deviation, extreme spread of your muzzle velocity, but maybe something that you couldn't explain.
Gotcha.
You know, loading is kind of, I guess, witchcraft and voodoo like that, and that when you don't see the results you want to see at the end of the line,
okay,
you're going to start to question all different aspects of your loading process.
So this goes back to the little variables.
Yes.
Make up the consistency.
Eliminating variables.
Yeah. Eliminating variables make up. That's where the consistency comes in.
It's the same idea as if you finally get out on your big hunt and you got that elk in your sights and you pull the trigger and you miss. Well, now you start to question everything about your process, your weapon system. Did you range them right? Was it the wind? You start questioning everything. So when you don't see the results at the end of the line during load development, if you hadn't taken these steps with your primer seating depth, that can then become a variable in your mind. Whereas if I know every primer cup is seated with zero forward movement, it's perfect, and each one is plus or minus a thousandth of each other, you don't have to worry about primer seating depth as a variable in your loads. So, you know, our process, and I guess I should say that, you know, our process, like you said, is not for everyone. The way we do things on a large scale, we do it very quickly with the best equipment, you know, so that we can you know, make quality ammunition. So using the Primal Rights competition primer seeder, for example, has a mechanical hard stop. Once we set depth on that first round and we check the next one, we just run them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you might quality check every 100 or so. Whereas if you're doing it yourself by hand or you're doing it at home, you know, you can check every one of them.
But every time you switch cases, you're checking those depths. That's just something you do on everything comes out on unknown munitions.
Yeah, and as you know, if you think about all the different brass that comes through the shop, everything has a different primer pocket seating depth. So it's the same process for us. When you go to seat that first primer, you're measuring that brass that we're using at that moment. You know, we're not loading just 50 at a time most of the time. It's usually more than that. So you'll make those initial measurements, and then you'll quality check every 50 or 100 or so to make sure everything is still good. But
gotcha.
That should be your general process. So just make sure you bottomed out your primer cup and make sure they're consistent one to another, plus or minus a thousandth of an inch. Yes.
It's crazy.
Okay, so we have a primed case now, and now we need to fill it up with powder. And that is also, I guess, kind of self-explanatory. Basically, mm-hmm. you're putting the powder in the case. And it really was the choice of tool you made that will determine how hard it is to get a consistent powder throw. So if we're talking about an auto trickler kit, they are kernel accurate powder throws every time. So dumping those powder charges into your cases, you know, you don't have to worry about any type of variable, and that's why we use those tools. If you're using a Charge Master or something else, guys use beam scales, guys are using, you know, any number of ways to measure powder, and again, the goal here is just making sure that your powder charge is consistent. If you can't tell me that it's a kernel accurate powder charge, then you're going to be compensating for that error in all the other parts of your... But this is where neck turn... There's so many parts of the voodoo that came in from trying to compensate from a bad powder charge initially.
And this goes to... You really need to go back and listen to part one on the equipment.
Yeah.
On the powder measures. Because I ask him, you know, why should you buy this? And he explains it. But I do have a funny... I listened to a podcast. It's a popular podcast. And the guy said he likes big cases, you know, like the 416 Barretts or the things over 100 grains of powder, because he can be off a little bit on his powder and it doesn't matter. And I was like, God, Jake's probably freaking rolling over there saying, what the hell?
I guess that would be just one of the things I'm talking about where you compensate, right? If everybody's trying to compensate for a bad powder charge or inconsistent powder charges, this guy in particular says, oh, the bigger the cartridge I shoot, the less variance I see in my loads. Well, you know, I guess that works.
That don't work at unknown munitions.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you're spending $10 a round to pull the trigger instead of just, you know, investing in a good tool. But so whatever powder measure you had chose, whatever tool you chose to measure your powder, just making sure the powder charges are consistent. There's really not a lot to say about that.
We did have a guy ask about the old school leveling thing. You remember that question?
The beam scale.
The beam scale, yeah.
Yeah.
What can you get consistent loads with those?
I think so. I think, you know, it's not about your beam scale being calibrated, but rather each charge being the same. So in any powder measure system, you have to look at what resolution is possible. So the little weight that he moves down the line, you know, is that weight 10th of a grain resolution? Because then, you know, you're the same situation as a Charge Master, where a 10th could mean 0.06 to 0.14.
Right.
And in the grand scheme of things, that's just not accurate enough. So it really depends on, of course, there's going to be some fancy, expensive beam scale that can measure down to 0.02 grains. And then the answer is yes, it's accurate enough. If you have a 10th of a grain resolution beam scale, it's not accurate enough.
Not enough.
And it depends on the quality of loads that you're after either. If you're loading for an AR that you shoot at 20 yards at the range, you're loading 223, then all this doesn't really apply. You know, we're not trying to get kernel accurate powder charges, but for the hunters, for the extreme long range, for the PRS type guys, you know, we're trying to minimize extreme spread and velocities, and powder charge has the most effect on that in your loading process. Want to touch base real quick. So many calls and emails about Trickler V3 and V4. So today's date is August 21st. So as of August 21st, here is the Trickler situation. We will still be receiving 3 shipments of 24 kits each from Auto Trickler. But Auto Trickler, I believe they're telling guys right now they don't have any more throws left, so they can only sell the Trickler by itself in a kit. We are getting 3 more shipments of the full kit. And then there won't be any more V3s at all until you can get a V4, which if you haven't already signed up to get a V4, you are well into next year before you get one.
Mm.
I don't know when we will get a first shipment of V4s that we can sell to the public. We don't really have a... It'll be this year, I think, maybe towards the end of the year or first of next year. So that being said, if you're looking for a Trickler, you need one now, definitely hit us up. Get a V3 lined up. Otherwise, you'll be waiting until next year for a V4. The other question is, should I wait for the V4? Is the V3 good enough? The V3, V4, end result and time to get there is the same. So the performance of the machine is the same. The time it takes to throw the powder charge is the same. So from a performance standpoint, they're the same. Now, it's a much, you know, smaller form factor on your bench top because everything's integrated into the lid. You don't have to deal with the cables or just the multiple pieces of the system. So it's going to be the same. So that's another question. It's going to be the same price. So if you can wait, I would tell you wait for the V4. If you can wait until middle of next year, then get your name on the list. Go to autotrickler.com and put your name on the wait list. And if you can wait, wait. If you can't wait, then you better hit us up and try to get one of the kits that's left. Otherwise, you will be forced to wait. So that's kind of the situation with those. We're supposed to get a couple in the shop soon for testing. I'll be posting on Instagram, you know, pictures and operation and kind of our feedback on it. And hopefully we'll run into any issues that might arise and get those fixed before they do their first production run. That way you guys don't have to deal with them. So that's the plan on those. So again, so we filled up the case. We primed the case. We filled it up with powder. Process-wise, just make sure your powder charge is as consistent as you can afford to make it. I guess is the best way to put it. Yeah.
But you can't buy the things you need.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that's the story of 2020 and 2021. Yeah.
I've heard of there's another company who's been advertising some new type of Trickler system on Facebook. It's the same idea, fits on top of FX120i scale, but they said they might have units for sale sometimes toward the end of the year.
You going to give it a try?
I think I'll get one just to, I think from an unknown munitions point of view, we have to try everything. Anything new that comes out, we have to try it to see if it's better than what we're doing.
Call that a write-off.
It is a write-off. It's a write-off, and then you guys can rely on us to kind of, I guess, post up some information. And,
absolutely.
And maybe it'll be, a podcast of its own at some point, maybe. But yeah, I would always say that's the nice thing about loading. Anything that you say, if I run the neck turning mandrel instead of the expander mandrel, what effect on my load will that have? Guys will ask a question like that. Well, the nice thing is you can load 10 up one way and load 10 up the other way and go to the range and see what effect it had on you. So, okay. So we're ready to put a bullet on top and push them in there. So seating bullets, process-wise, I like to break this down. Obviously, there's a press and a die involved to seat the bullet. So we'll first talk we'll talk about the dies first. And there are 2 different types of seating dies to start with. And I like to call them cam over and non-cam over. The difference is when you set your die up, do you run your die down to touch the shell holder? And that's your starting point, or that's where you set your die up for height in your press. Or do you run a piece of brass up into the die with the ram all the way up and then screw your die down on top of the brass, back it off a quarter turn and lock it down? Those are kind of the 2 different types of dies. So Widen and Redding competition seater dies are set up as cam over dies. So you screw it down till it touches. That means that with the shell holder at its highest position on the stroke, there is enough room for the brass inside the die without crushing it. And the idea of cam over is if you're not using, now don't use this process on a zero press, but because there's zero movement in the ram at the bottom position, you can't use what you call cam over. You end up putting too much mechanical force into the die. you're just going to start breaking stuff. So if you have a Redding T7 or any other type of linkage press that's not a zero, you're going to have some amount of play, up and down play in the ram movement because of the pins and the way it's designed, that you're trying to pull all that play out of the press by the way you set your die up. And that's when we start talking about cam over. So the first thing I would say is if you have to choose between a die manufacturer, choose a die that has cam over available. Don't get the cheap die that's, you know, if you spend $15-$20 on a die, that'll be the die that you screw down with a piece of brass all the way up into it, screw it down till it touches, back it off a quarter and lock it down. You can't eliminate all the play from the press with that type of die. So cam over, you're rotating all of the mechanical force till it just pivots under the bottom of the ram. So as you guys are pulling that lever down, there is a point at which it stops. And that's where your mechanical fulcrum, I'm not a damn engineer. The mechanical fulcrum or the force ends up pivoting under the ram. And that's where you get that last little click at the bottom of the lever stroke. That'll be your cam over. Now, not a lot is needed. You're just making sure that the shell holder is finishing at the same position under the die every time. That's the goal. The goal for seating depth consistency, there's seating stem also, but we're talking about the bottom end. So the goal for seating depth consistency is making sure that the case head of the brass finishes at the same spot every time. Because if your brass is stopping at different positions, even plus or minus a thousandth, you're introducing that as a seating depth variance where your bullet, because your bullet is the final point at the top. So the different dies, so cam over, non-cam over, get a cam over if you can. When you're setting that die up, you're trying to find that last little bit of click at the end as your bit of cam over where the shell holder finishes at the bottom of the die.
Do you just, Whiting and Redding, do you prefer one over the other? Or?
So guys definitely asking that all the time. My response is that both dies, I would say quality and the final result is generally the same. Now, the difference where it comes in for us is the amount of surface area impact between the seating stem and the bullet. So we run every bullet you can imagine through the shop. So if you had to seat 15 different bullet types and shapes in the same cartridge that you shoot, you'd be concerned with how that seating stem impacts those bullets. So if you guys are getting a ring around your bullet, something like this, some deformation of the bullet that you don't like, it's because there's not enough surface area contact between the seating stem and the bullet. So Whiting seating stems, the internal shape of the seating stem applies to a wider variety of bullets that we run through here. So we run into less impact deformations on the bullet. You know, on a normal daily, you know, process, we're, you know, a few thousand, 4,000 rounds a day or so. We run into less issues with those seating stems than with Redding. Now, Redding, you buy a Redding die, it already has the non-VLD stem. So now you're already having to upgrade to the VLD stem for almost all the bullets you'd ever load. Then you got to pick between the long and the short. And something like if you get a Whiting seater die in 28 Nosler, they're actually going to give you the short and the long seating stem because they know that some guys are running Sammy spec, some guys are running 28 Nosler way longer than normal. So in order to get a short 28 Nosler, you would have the longer stem. And then to get a longer 28 Nosler, you'd use the shorter stem. But that was a good choice. I mean, good question. A lot of guys asking all the time. So I guess there's not a perfect die yet. Maybe there's some room in the market there for some engineer to come up with the perfect die. I know that there's some dies out there now that apply to like a wide range of cartridges, like 6 and 6.5. You can run the same die to cover almost all the different cartridges. I think that's
really
short action precision.
That's cool.
Yeah, making
if
a die
it's consistently. That's cool.
Yeah, we haven't used them. And again, that's because it doesn't really apply to our process, guys. I'm sure there's plenty of guys out there listening right now that might have one, and I'm sure it works great. We just add more presses with more dies so we don't have to move them around.
Yeah.
So seating the bullet, if you picture this as a mechanical process in your mind, as the brass is moving up into the die, you want the bottom of the brass to finish at the same spot every time so that the top where the seating stem is touching the bullet, everything comes together, squishes in, and finishes the same way every time. there are plenty of variables that can get in between that and make it, you know, make your seating depth not consistent. So I guess if you're quality checking your ammo from one to the next, and make sure that you're quality checking your seating depth to the ogive, not to the tip of the bullet or the mi-pla.
Now, I got a question on that one. So I see it all the time. People say, if you have a tip bullet, you don't have to do it that way.
True and not true. I guess it depends on the type of the tipped bullet. For example, A-tips are super consistent. So in our situation, we're always to the ogive anyway. And as a hand loader, if you get in the process of being to the ogive, then you avoid any issues, right? But if we were running A-tips, you can measure to the tip. But there may be, let's say, plus or minus a thousandth of variance between the ogive and the tip of an A-tip. So then when you measure your base to tip for consistency, there's already some inconsistency there because of bullet manufacturing. So it always makes sense to measure to the ogive no matter what bullet you're using. I would just say that. I mean, why not? That's just one more variable in your process. So get comfortable with your measuring and your QC process while you're seating bullets, and that way you don't make any mistakes on your side. But A-tips are very consistent, more consistent than ELDs, and that has to do with because when A-tips come off the production line, they are packaged as they come off the line. That's probably why, you know, that's a little bit about why they're more expensive. But as they're put in that A-tip box, it's as they came off the production line, whereas ELDs, they just go into this big bin. So bullet number 12 and bullet number 10,012 may be in the same box of bullets that you get.
Jake doesn't like them because they take up twice the room.
they do take up a lot of shelf room.
The box is like three times bigger than every other box.
Yeah, and they require a little bit of cleaning.
Yes, they have like a little, looks like a Crown Royal bag that comes with them. You got to shake it up and move them around.
Yeah, and guys are asking too, you know, there are plenty of guys out there hunting with those. I know Hornady doesn't recommend it, but there are guys killing stuff with them.
I do not recommend them in a 300 Terminator.
Yeah.
They're a little explosive.
A little too much horsepower.
Unless you're shooting them way out there.
Yeah. So seating the bullet, again, just trying to get a mental picture of that brass moving in the die, I think is the easiest way to understand it. So we've talked about making sure the shell holder finishes in the same position each time. You can do that with cam over, or if you just buy a zero press, that shell holder finishes in the same spot every single time, which is amazing.
Jake's always upselling you.
Yeah. But that's not the first big investment you should make in your loading process. By far, if you had $1,000 to spend and you're like, where would my process benefit the most with $1,000 investment? It is the auto trickler, hands down. There would be no question. In fact, the press might be the last.
Really?
The last investment I might make. Because if you use the right type of die with cam over, you can make any press just as good with cam over. So if you had a Whitten die on a zero press and a Whitten die on a Redding T7 that's been, you know, wore out for the last 10 years, you can still get the same result as long as your setup is good. So
good to know.
Yeah, so seating the bolt. So then the seating stem, we talked a lot about that. If you guys are using a Redding die, whatever die it is that you're using, there's either a stationary seating stem, and that's actually what you're twisting on the top. If you have the cheap die, when you make your adjustment on the top, you're actually adjusting the seating stem. If you have a more expensive competition seater die, it has a micrometer on top. There will be a stem inside that's kind of like sleeved in there. And so again, if you think about the seating stem hitting the bullet and the shell holder and the case head at the bottom coming together and minimizing variance, if you're compressing your load, the compression action of the powder and the variance in height of the powder inside the case is going to cause variance in your bullet seating depth. We posted on Instagram a video of using those sonic toothbrushes to settle the powder. Man, that stirred them up. That stirred everybody up pretty good.
I've heard a drop tube. I've heard a lot of things, but I never heard of using a toothbrush.
Yeah. A guy told me he's got a prototype right now of a tray that has a sonic vibrator built into the tray.
Nice.
He's getting it all flush mounted in the bottom. So you buy his tray and you just flick the switch and then, you know, all 50 at a time are being settled, which is amazing.
Yeah. And it does make sense. I mean,
because we spend a lot of time with toothbrushes.
I imagine, especially on those compressed loads, you got to get them consistently compressed, you know?
So that would be, you know, settling that powder was a step we put in our process, you know, as a high volume ammo manufacturer to make sure we get that seating depth consistency, because seating depth consistency is definitely paramount for the quality of your loads, you know, at the end of the line. So, yeah, so using a sonic toothbrush, you can buy a cheap one on Amazon. Use the back of the toothbrush. If you vibrate the case, that sonic vibration is allowing the powder to fill in the little gap. So you'll, especially with N570 and the 300 PRC, you'll notice a quarter inch difference, like literally a quarter of an inch from where the powder was to where the powder will settle to.
It's basically charcoal briquettes you're putting in. I mean,
yeah,
it's freaking huge.
Yeah. And of course, the finer the powder, the smaller the powder becomes, the less this is a problem, right? Like, right. If we're talking about H4350, that's not really needed. If you're compressing your load, it's because you got too much. So, yeah. And not that there can be too much, but yeah. So N570 is a big one of the main powders. Like, we have scales set aside just for N570, and settling that powder to get, you know, optimal case fill is important. So make sure if you're a compressed load, you know that that will have an impact on your seating depth consistency. And shit in the seating stem. Like, we run a lot of rounds, and I'll come out here and they'll, you know, one of the technicians will say, oh, I'm getting a variance in the seating depth. What's going on here? And I'll pull the die apart, and the seating stem is just full of shit. Like, obviously shit moving around inside the seating stem is going to change, you know, your seating depth and where the bullet is impacting that stem. So if you're to clean your die, the seating stem's mating surfaces, so inside the stem and wherever that micrometer is hitting the top of the stem, all those surfaces need to be clean.
How do you clean yours out?
I just use like a brake cleaner, electrical cleaner. We'll disassemble it, and they'll throw some gloves on and take everything out back in a bin and spray it all down, put it all back together. We don't use any type of lube on the die at all. It takes a lot of rounds through a die to wear it out. Now, we have went through some of the major cartridges, let's say like 6.5 Creedmoor. We're probably on our third set of dies for 6.5 Creedmoor just because of how often we're running it.
Gotcha.
But, you know, the average loader in his garage is not going to wear a die out. So, but the cleaning of it, I guess, is probably not so much for die life as it is for seating depth consistency. So any mating surface to the stem or the micrometer or whatever adjustment might be there on your die, making sure those areas are clean. Very important. So I think we talked a lot about seating bullets.
Yep. I think we need to roll into, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but just your process of once you get once fired.
Yes. Once fired brass is going to add a few more steps to the, now the process we already discussed is still the same.
Correct.
We need to talk about, you know, how do you get to that first step where we started to expand that new brass? So fired brass comes in, you have a spent primer that has a dimple in it, obviously. Mm-hmm. And there was a, I think it was a gentleman named Chris that had sent a message in, and he wanted to ask about decapping brass. We do recommend to decap on a separate press because that soot and carbon and junk that comes from taking that primer apart. Okay.
We have somebody's cutting something beside us, and it's, we don't know if we can hear it or not in the microphone. So yeah. It's always fun doing podcasts.
Yeah. So, okay. So fired brass. So we have to decap it. And we had a guy named Chris reach out because we recommended to use a separate press for decapping operations. When you're pushing primers out, they kind of come apart. There's soot, there's dirt. I don't know about dirt, but there's, you know, they're coming apart and they're leaving junk all around your press. And I learned pretty early on, that's not where you want to, you don't want to eat where you shit, basically. So this is like the correct shit part of the operation. We want to keep the seating press clean.
Right.
So his question was, do you have to, if he had, I think it was a Forester coax or something, he's saying, if it has this tube and this thing that the primer goes through, do I still need a separate press? And bottom line is, if your press doesn't get dirty, then it's fine. You know, but if you notice that you're contaminating.
I don't know how you wouldn't get a press dirty running prime shot.
I know it. Like, even with the zero press, the zero has a specific hole in it where, you know, all the way at the top of the stroke, and it falls down this tray. And that actually does work pretty well. But either way, you can, I know presses might not be cheap right now, but you guys can get a little Lee you know, O-frame type press for, I think I bought those for $40 or $50 at the time. And I guess my answer would be, why not?
You look on Craigslist every day, you see reloading presses. Yeah. Dang near. I seen like four the other day on Craigslist.
Yeah. I mean, if it's a space issue or money issue, something like that, I mean, basically just keep your press clean, but it's just another way to eliminate variables for us. Yeah, don't shit where you eat.
No, it's, to me, it's a no-brainer because that's why it's just dirty. That powder residue goes everywhere.
It does.
And it freaking gets on everything. So if you can eliminate that filth, I would.
We even put it on a separate side of the shop just to make sure.
It's like 20 feet away.
Yeah, so, okay, so we talked, so decapping, again, any type of decapping dye is fine as long as it does the job and you push the brass up into it. There's a pin that comes down the middle and pushes the primer out the other side, and the primer's put wherever, you know, your tool's put in the primer, and that's that. It's decapped now. The next step in that process is full-length sizing for us, and now there's a lot of, I don't want to call it debate, but everybody always asks, like, why do you anneal after you size? So our step is decap, full-length size and shoulder bump, anneal, and then after annealing, we get right to the expanding part. And that would be back at the new brass process. But we anneal after to maintain that anneal mark. When it looks better.
Are you tumbling that? Where does your tumble come in?
Yeah, okay. So we decapped. So then I guess it'll be a little bit of a conversation, talk about full-length sizing. And it's pretty difficult without like a visual aid. But this is always a big drawing and probably a good amount of class time in person to try and explain what's happening when you're sizing the brass and all the different dimensions that are being pushed in. But I guess I'll start by, you know, as the brass is entering in your sizing die, the die is smaller along the body lines. The long body lines of the brass are already starting to be pushed in, and that's the resistance you're feeling as the brass is being pushed into the die. And when you get to the top stroke of your ram inside the sizing die, that's when the shoulder bump should happen, you know, once you've set everything up properly. So as you're pushing the brass, again, trying to picture the mechanical action of what's happening, the brass is entering the die, it's being pushed in from the sides by the die, so the body is being squeezed in. If you had no shoulder bump built into your die, the brass actually gets longer. Mm-hmm. So if we put some numbers on it, if you measured... Now, if you guys listen to the first part of the podcast, this is where we're using that shoulder bump gauge in our comparator. So shoulder bump gauge in the comparator on the caliper, you've measured your fired base to shoulder measurement. That fired base to shoulder measurement might be something like, let's just put a round number on it, 3.000. So you have a baseline now for fired base to shoulder. And target shoulder bump for most guys, somewhere 1 to 3 thousandths. We're on the 3 thousandths side because we've had customers that like to fire the same brass in different rifles with different headspace, min-max. So anyway, so 1 to 3 thousandths is fine. And you have your baseline measurement of 3.000. Let's go back to die setup shit. I'm kind of all over the place here. But basically running your ram, your shell holder to the top of its stroke. So you pull the lever down, shell holder's all the way at the top. Screw your sizing die down until it touches the shell holder. Tighten it down. That's your starting point. On everything but a zero press. We can't do that on a zero, can't do that on a zero press. But for most guys, that's your starting point. So then you put your piece of brass in. It's lubed up. You run that lubed brass up inside again as the brass is entering the die. There's force from the sides of the case pushing it in. You have your baseline base to shoulder measurement. You size that brass, you pull the brass out, you measure again, and now it's 3.003. You're like, what the hell just happened? How did my brass get longer? Well, if you picture squeezing the sides of that brass, it makes it grow longer. You're displacing brass one way or another, and instead of, if there's no force pushing down from the top, as you push in from the sides, it's just like squeezing shit out of a bag.
This is a hard concept for people to understand. When I sold Bertram brass, I tried to explain on the phone, I bet you 100 times this process. So this is good. This is good.
So picture squeezing shit out of a bag. You squeeze the sides of the bag and the shit comes out the top. Well, as you're squeezing the sides of the brass, the shit's coming out the top. It's mm-hmm. making the base to shoulder longer. And again, that's if we haven't bumped the shoulder at all. So we went from 3.000. We sized a piece of brass. Now it's 3.003. Right? So now what do you do? Well, we have to screw the die down a bit. So you're going to go up to your die. And if this was a situation, if it went from 3 to 3.003, we know we haven't touched the brass yet. So I'm going to probably come down a quarter turn on the die.
You haven't touched the shoulder yet.
Haven't touched the shoulder of the brass yet right. with the die. So if you picture, if the inside of the die is the same shape as the cartridge, there mm-hmm. is a shoulder inside the die. And mm-hmm. this is where we're talking about. The height of that shoulder in relationship to the brass. So we're going to, in that situation, I would screw the sizing die down about a quarter of an inch. You're going to size the same piece of brass. Now you pulled it out. You pull it out and you measure the base to shoulder again. Well, now it's 3.001. So now I know I'm touching the shoulder. I'm just not touching it enough. So now we're literally looking for an additional. Now, maybe you guys want to write these numbers down when you're looking at it. But so our baseline was 3,000. Our size with no shoulder bump was 3,003. And now on the third sizing, I'm at 3,001. I need to come down 2 to 4 thousandths to get within my spec, my 1 to 3 thousandths spec under baseline. So now I'm not going to screw it down a quarter. That's way too much. Now I'm going to lower the die just a bit. I'm going to size it again. I lower the die a bit. I size it again. Voila, I'm at 2,999. So if you're not quite comfortable with just 1 thousandth under, then you can give it another bump and try again. But at this point, we have sized the brass and bumped the shoulder back 1 thousandth, mm-hmm. which is, to me, acceptable if your range was 1 to 3. Us, we would lower it down the same amount again to get that extra 2 thousandths and get to 3 thousandths shoulder bump.
So will you tell people why you don't want it the same size as your actual chamber?
Yeah, so I mean, if your headspace, if you fired your brass and it's 3,000 and you bump the shoulder back to 3,000 in the sizing operation, if there was anything in your chamber, now I always use the beard hair example, but basically, so I got a red beard. If you take a beard hair and cut it in 8 pieces long ways, each one of those is 1/1000. If one piece of that beard hair that was cut 8 times gets in your chamber, your bolt may not close. So in a field application, or really any application, you don't want the chance of not being able to close your bolt because some shit got in there. So absolutely. That's the reason for the shoulder bump.
Grass, dirt, who knows?
It could be anything.
And why don't you want to, you know, bump that back 6, 7, 8, 9 thousandths?
Yeah, because then that's just too much. You're overworking your brass at that point. We only need a few thousandths. You could bump it that far, and as long as it's consistent, you'd be okay. But you'd start to overwork the case head of your brass, and you'll just get premature brass failure at that point.
I can't prove this, but I've taken so many calls with the Bertram about case head separation, and I think it's people are, you know, basically pushing it back to virgin brass size, and that's slamming forward, and, you know, they're 5 or 6 reloads in, and then they have that, you know, separation. And I'm assuming Bertram has their problems, but I'm assuming that people are overworking their brass most times with a case head separation.
Yeah, and it can be. We've seen brass and dies and chambers mismatched in a way. And I think we did a podcast with ADG that'll be coming out next, but mm-hmm. we talked a little bit about this with the 6.5 PRC sizing mm-hmm. issues. And there are so many variables between your chamber and your rifle, the size of new brass, and the spec of your die, that at some point you're going to run into an issue. With as many people as are loading ammunition mm-hmm. and firing ammunition and reloading ammunition and all the manufacturers of all these different products, how many people are making reamers? There's custom reamer specs. There's bad dies, good dies. There's bad brass, good brass. All of these different variables are going to allow, there's going to be some issues at some point with mismatches. And then that's not even bringing in headspace to it. Then there's headspace, you know, so I think at some point you're going to run into case head separation is either from overworking the shoulder or overworking the case head area itself. I mean, if you, if your specs on all these different variables, we talked about chamber versus die versus brass versus headspace, if you're overworking the sizing of the side of the case head, that can become an issue too.
Gotcha. All right, so we're bumping back our 1 to 3 thousandths.
Yes. At that point, like as we're sizing the brass and everything's going smooth, we're actually taking that brass right out of the die and throwing it into the tumbler bucket right then. That kind of voids, so I guess I should have said we lubed this brass up before we size it.
You said you lubed it. What do you use for lube, by the way?
We're using a lanolin alcohol mix of 10 to 1. So lanolin, for those of you that don't know, we get 100% lanolin oil. It is in excretion from sheepskin. It's what keeps the wool moist and supple. Yeah, so they, I guess when they're processing wool from a sheep, they're extracting that oil off the sheep's wool, and then they process it and purify it. And so what you're buying is 100% lanolin oil. Now, that's what we use. We use a lot of lube through the shop, and, you know, any of those Hornady one-shot lubes or whatever lube you might be using, I'm sure is fine. But if you're interested in using the lanolin oil alcohol mix, it's 10 to 1 that we use. 100% lanolin oil, we buy it on Amazon. Guys are saying recently, because of all the hand sanitizer and COVID mess, you know, alcohol, pure alcohol can be hard to find. So there is isopropyl alcohol, which is straight alcohol diluted with water, right? And depending on the percentage of isopropyl alcohol that you're getting, if it says 70%, that means the other 30% is water. And as you're letting this flash off, and we'll talk about flashing off in a second, it just means it takes a little bit longer to flash off. Then there's denatured alcohol. That's actually alcohol that they sell cheaper, like Home Depot, Lowe's, wherever you might go get denatured alcohol. It's used as a fuel for like stoves and stuff, right?
Denatured?
Denatured. it is denatured.
Oh, I thought it was denatured for some reason.
Either way, it's denatured. So the reason they denature the alcohol, they actually add stuff into the alcohol to make it so you can't drink it.
Oh, really?
That's required so that they can sell it the way they sell it. Otherwise, everybody would just go to the store and buy denatured alcohol and start drinking it. Like, so it actually has stuff to make you sick.
Good.
In the alcohol. Whereas isopropyl alcohol, you know, you could, I guess, chug away.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting. I've never heard anybody say denatured, so now I'm going to...
I don't know if I'm right or not. Usually I am, but I mean, I could be wrong once.
It's interesting when you hear like enunciations of words, though, right? Because you never think about... Like, everybody looks at a word their own way.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm from freaking Post Falls, Idaho. I make up words all the time. Yeah. Ask my wife.
Anyways.
Constantly correcting me.
You guys can use either one. I think it's about 10% of shit they put in the denatured alcohol versus you'll know the percentage of water in the isopropyl alcohol. Either one is acceptable for this purpose. It just might take a little bit longer to flash off. So when I say flash off, you're using the alcohol to break the lanolin oil down so that it basically becomes an aerosol. You don't want to sit there and rub oil all over each case. You're trying to mist this oil. So you spray the brass a few times and then you let it sit there. So the alcohol evaporates at a low temperature compared to water. So the alcohol evaporates and it leaves that mist of lanolin oil as your lube. If you don't allow it to flash off or you use too much lube, if any of you listen to this have ever had a dimple in the shoulder after you sized your brass, it's because you had too much lube. Too much lube is bad. Almost in any situation, it's not. But in this situation, too much lube is not a good thing.
Before you throw it in the tumbler, do you wipe it off or you just throw it straight in the tumbler?
Yeah, so no, it goes straight out of the die, straight into the tumbler bucket. So we talked about in the first one, we used those STM Rebel 17 tumblers, which we're carrying now, by the way. So
one-stop shopping.
If you're looking for a tumbler, they're on the site now. And you can get it with 10 pounds of the right media, and it even comes with your big bucket of Lemishine to go with it. But anyways, so we come right out of the sizing die, throw it right into the bucket. We'll carry that bucket when it's full. We'll put hot water to about an inch off the top, a teaspoon of Lemishine. I just call it a few big swirls, but we grab the heavy-duty bottle of Dawn soap and give it, you know, a few swirls inside there, you're not going to hurt anything with extra soap. So just make sure that soap is what grabs on to all the shit that comes off the brass and keeps it from going back on the brass. So you're not going to hurt nothing with some extra soap. So fill it all up, goes on the tumbler for 2 hours, and it's clean, ready to go.
It's shiny. I just looked at some in there.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, because we got some reloads here for Ryan. Let's see what those are.
Yeah.
Looks like new.
300 WSM. You got that nice looking little.
So if you tump that anneal look comes off in the tumbler, which is why we anneal after the tumbling but before the expanding. And if you anneal every single firing, which we do, it doesn't matter at which step in the process you do it, because the brass has never actually gotten to that work hardened state. You're annealing it every time at some point. Annealing every time, you know, you can anneal at any point in the process you'd like. So
looks good.
Dude, that's a thing of beauty right there. So once the brass is tumbled, 2 hours, and we use those tumblers don't come with a timer. We just buy a timer off Amazon, $10 or whatever. It's a twist timer.
Mm-hmm.
2 hours are up, and you got this bucket of dirty water with brass inside. We use the Lyman sifter trays. We bring it into the sink, and you pour the whole bucket down the sifter tray and turn the water on so the water's rinsing off the... You don't want soap. Any soap residue or water that's left on the brass when you dry it, you're going to see it in the final product. So you'd have... There'd be water spots and soap streaks all over that if it hadn't been rinsed and dried properly. It wouldn't look new like that.
Yeah, and you don't want it to sit in that tumbler very long.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to let it dinge up and sit overnight. I should mention, too, there's a friend of mine that when I told him, he sent me a picture of some dingy brass. I said, oh, you're not using enough soap. So I said, he said, I put one squirt. And I said, well, maybe you need two squirts. So he sent me a video. I'll tell you who it is after this. But he sent me a video, and he's got this fucking industrial-sized soap thing with the big giant pump on top. You know what I mean? So one squirt was like a half a cup of soap, right? A half a cup. So he sends me a picture, and he's doing this squirt like this. And he says, one squirt and then two squirt. It was just this massive amount of soap. So we're not talking about the industrial soap pumper here. I'm talking about the dish soap from your wife's sink, or I shouldn't say it that way. The dish soap from your sink.
Yeah. Just and, a little bit of Dawn would go a long ways.
Yeah. But not the industrial size squirt. So now you're separating, you got the water running over the brass. The stainless, the goal here is to rinse the brass and separate the media from the brass. Whatever process you might use is fine as long as there's no stainless left in the brass and there's no soap residue. Once it's all cleaned up, we actually put it in the middle of a bath towel. And I'm doing this.
Yeah, this is more difficult that video than I thought it would be.
Yeah, so you just lay a towel out on the counter, put your brass in the middle of the bath towel, not your good bath towel.
Yeah.
Get the junk one that already's got stains on it. Put it right in the middle and roll up the long, so reach out left and right and grab the long ends, roll them up, and then you're going to tilt it side to side and let the brass roll inside the towel back and forth, and that's going to remove all that water from the outside of the brass. Otherwise, you're going to get spots. And if spots don't matter to you, then don't worry about this. If streaks don't matter to you, you don't got to do. You don't even have to stainless tumble your brass.
I think you do.
This, for us in our business,
right.
Yes.
No, but I mean, if it looks good, it is good, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you'll talk to bench rest guys that are, you know, shooting bitty groups at 1,000 yards. And, you know, they'll tell you that soot or carbon is the best neck lube around. You know, and they want to leave that bit of residue inside. So, and I think, Greg uses rice, and he was kind of convincing me on the phone the other day. So when we get on the
he
on
cleans
the podcast,
it with rice?
He uses rice. And so
like in a vibrating tumbler?
Yeah. So we'll let him talk more about that in the future. That'll be an interesting conversation. So whatever, you know, it can be clean or not clean. However you want to run it is fine. But the process we're talking about literally makes the ammunition look like new.
That's cool.
And so it's been, now it's dry in the towel. Then it goes into, we just use a Lyman dryer. And all it is a food dehydrator. So those of you that are putting your brass in the kitchen oven, that's fine as long as it has a low temp. You don't want to cook your brass. But once it's all dry, it is ready to anneal. So we use amp annealers. It's pretty much the gold standard out of there. Whatever process you use to anneal, if you don't, you should. It's time to anneal it. once the brass is annealed, we're back to the beginning.
We're back to the beginning of the podcast.
The beginning of the podcast. Maybe we should have started off with fired, and then we would have moved.
It kind of goes off the equipment. You're hand loading. You know, you're getting virgin brass 99% of the time, so that should be where it starts, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then once fired, then you're going on the next. But if people want to learn more about the whole process, you got a class in a week and a half, and I'm sure you're going to have more. So they need to sign up for those classes. You go from the basically nose to tail. You start the same thing, and you go all the way through the process. And you got hands on where you can walk up and you can actually touch the products.
Yeah, you can ask your own questions. So we have one class left in Coeur d'Alene. It's the 21st today. It's on the 28th.
Yeah, I'll probably get this out this week, so you'll have a couple days. We live in Coeur d'Alene area. You have any spots open?
Yeah, I think there's three or four left on the site.
But you're going to have more coming.
Yeah, so we're moving into a new shop November 1st time frame, and we're going to start offering more classes as well. So we've had a lot of requests for load development classes. We're thinking about doing like a two-day deal, come into the shop with your rifle. We're going to walk you through loading your own load development, measuring your rifle, how we get there, and then go shoot it that day. And there's always a second session needed, so we'll come back the next day to the shop, load the second test, go back and shoot it, and then come back to the shop and kind of review how to interpret the data and what we do in our process. I think that's going to be pretty awesome, to be honest with you. We're going to try to do one maybe like the shoulder seasons, maybe spring, fall, something like that. And I think we're planning something to do with you too, huh?
Yep.
You want to talk about it?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not quite yet till we get the actual deets.
Okay. Well, we're going to do something.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome in the field.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. We're going to have something that it's been done, but I don't think it's been done to this level.
Yes.
But,
I'm going to take it to level 42.
Yeah. Should be around December. We'll come out with that. But we got a lot more coming on this process. We got, we did ADG Brass. We did a podcast with them. We're trying to line it up with getting, what's his name from Primal Rights? I keep forgetting.
Yeah, Greg Dykstra.
Greg Dykstra. We're trying to get Brian Litz. We're trying to get a few other people that are kind of experts in their craft in the long range hunting side.
Yeah, as it applies to
and hunting. Ammo deconstructed.
That's right. That's right. Perfect.
So again, if you want to get a hold of me, or if you have any ideas that we're missing that you want to hear us talk about, or go find somebody, get a hold of Jake at Unknown Munitions. I think sales@unknownmunitions.com, or get a hold of me. You can get a hold of me pretty much through Rockslide or Ryan@AveryAdventures.com. So either way, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.